Today is day three of this June 2009 7-day session. We've gone on a long digression over the last couple of days, talking about what the meaning of Hongzhe's words about authentic practice mean. Let's just repeat those four lines from our Cultivating the Empty Field. A patch-robed monk's authentic task is to practice the essence. In each minute event, carefully discerning the shining source, radiant without discrimination, one colour unstained. You must keep turning inward, then the source is apprehended. So, the last couple of teishos, we've really been looking at how we start this process of carefully discerning the shining source in each minute event, in moment by moment. And this begins with the regulation of the body and the mind. But at some point, we have to move beyond regulation entirely. The second part of this first sentence really is referring to this. When Hongzhe says, radiant without discrimination, one colour unstained. So today, I'd like to look into this moving beyond regulation. We'll start off by taking a look at it through the lens of breath practice with Alan Wallace here in our other text, The Four Immeasurables, and hopefully clarify exactly what turning inward means. You must keep turning inward, then the source is apprehended. Actually, there are two different kinds of inward attention that are active in the early stages of practice. And this is set out in The Four Immeasurables by Alan Wallace in a way that I think is very helpful. This is in a section headed The Mastery of Attention, Mindfulness and Introspection. So we're going to read and comment on this section. Much of the time, our attention is compulsive. We don't really want to attend to distracting thoughts while we are meditating, and yet we do. The directing of awareness has a lot to do with will, but it is not always will-driven. When it is compulsive, it is probably object-driven. For example, if we become enraged, we may not want to be focusing on the thing that enrages us, and yet that's exactly where the attention goes. It's not because of some external stimulus. We could be sitting alone in a room, and yet the mind is compelled to attend this enraging object. I think all of us experience this at some point in practice, and it can be very disturbing to recognize just how, even when we want to stay focus, we want to keep our attention on the practice, we don't. We talk a lot in Zen about letting go of our thoughts. When we say this, it covers a lot of ground. We're really not talking about just random thoughts that flit in and out of the mind. These aren't really particularly serious. What we also have to deal with, though, is, could say, herds of thoughts, cities of thoughts, that are all kind of interrelated. There's a helpful term from psychology for this. Call these the complexes. And really they're sort of aggregations of ideas about ourselves and the world, emotional patterns, habitual reactions to things. And when we experience this compulsion to come back to our often painful thoughts, even, we can be pretty sure that there's some kind of sticky complex lying beneath this, like a big sort of web, to which things adhere. And it's in the nature of complexes that we're not conscious of them. And this is why they have so much power over us, because they are usually unconscious, or at best partially conscious of them. And I think it's a fact that we're not going to just get rid of these things in one fell swoop. Really, what we need to do is just to start to notice their patterns, and in this way become conscious of them. A certain pattern of reacting, certain stimuli, perhaps. But even doing this, even being able to see that is a big step, because they won't hook us in the same way. We can say, oh yeah, that's my negative father complex, or whatever it is. We don't even have to analyze it that much. We can find a way to just label it without trying to do psychotherapy on the mat. And of course, ultimately what we do is we just see it as a complex of thoughts and emotions while we're sitting, and then we can, in that moment, release that. The complex may still be there, but it's no longer ruling over us. Somebody said to me this morning that they were taking a drink in the water table, and the steam from their hot water rose up and steamed up their glasses. And that's happened to me too. When you have a steaming cup of tea or water, and this is a little bit like what a complex is. It becomes this fog through which we apprehend the world. It's not just an ordinary sort of uniform fog. It's more like some kind of distorting lens often. The word for, the traditional word in Buddhism for defilements, klesa, is etymologically related to a word that means twisted. Our defilements distort our view. They push it out of shape, and they make things complicated. It's not by accident that these webs of defilement are called complexes. They create complications. Of course, those complications are in fact, gold to the practitioner, because they point us to places where transformation is needed. We all have them. We all get hooked from time to time. But the more presence of mind we can bring to those moments, the more they can be transformed into fuel of transformation, of change. He goes on, shamatha is designed to give us not just control of attention, but freedom of attention. If we wish to attend to the breath, we have the freedom to attend to the breath. If we wish to attend to something else, we have the freedom to attend to that. It can be quite a shock when we realize how little freedom we have. One of the instructions we get when working on koan, or the breath, is to put our whole heart into it. And yet we can find out pretty quickly that we don't even know what that is, let alone are able to muster it up when we want to and pour it into the practice. So we're in a sense we're training ourselves to move towards being able to be wholehearted on demand. He continues, mastery of the attention is an extraordinary feat. In the Buddhist context, the mastery of attention is more than a psychological accomplishment. Not only have you gained mastery in a very significant way over your own mind, mastering your attention starts to influence your environment as well. Shantideva, for instance, declares that all manner of external dangers can be subdued by mastering one's own mind. I don't think this is referring to some kind of magic or something mysterious, but just to the fact that if we are paying attention, we will notice dangers. We will see the danger for what it is and will respond. Hear of the Jews in Nazi Germany, and there were many who recognized what was happening and got out, and there were others who didn't see what was coming, who stayed and who perished. Coming up to our present time, there are perhaps less obvious dangers that some people are seeing, others not. That some have seen coming for a long time and others haven't. Example of this would be peak oil and global warming. Look at U.S. auto industry now, who for decades suppressed the development of alternative fuels, and now are like dinosaurs producing these huge great SUVs, and they're in terrible trouble, barely limping along thanks to money from taxpayers to keep them going. Example of ignorance, lack of response to changing situation. environment. All manner of external dangers can be subdued by mastering one's own mind. When we don't master our mind, we're prey to our defilements, to our greed, our hostility, our delusive thinking. He continues. When we find that the mind has become distracted, a traditional time-tested solution is simply to take a greater interest in the main object, the breath of the koan. Attend to each breath as something utterly unprecedented. This breath will never come back. There will be another breath, but this one is unique. Attend to it with a playful quality and a light touch. That was neat. Two breaths in a row. How about three? See if you can maintain this quality of attention without becoming heavy and morose, mouth grimacing under the discipline. Play with it, but don't make it conceptually elaborate. Insofar as you can take more interest in each breath, it's preferable to have an interest that is uncomplicated rather than an interest that is complicated. We're told again and again in Zen to simplify. I can remember clearly how, in working on Mu, I would find that I had got myself into knots. Something as simple as keeping the mind on Mu become incredibly Byzantine and convoluted. It's just experiencing my own mind at that point. It's here that the letting go comes in. You can get into these totally tied up in knots. And yet, if we just see that as complexity, then we can release it. We may have to do that again in the next 3 seconds, but we can do that repeatedly, and eventually things will suddenly get simpler. There are two distinct qualities of awareness to cultivate in the shamatha practice: mindfulness and introspection. They are defined very specifically in the Tibetan Buddhist context, which is somewhat different from the Theravada context. So I guess we're getting the Tibetan version here. Mindfulness is that faculty or mode of awareness that is directly concerned with a familiar object, in this case the tactile sensations associated with the breath. In this practice, mindfulness is a continuum, an unbroken stream, attending to the in-breath, the out-breath, and also those interim moments between the breaths. The sole task of mindfulness is to attend to the object with continuity. It's like the beating of the heart. You always want it to be happening. If it's not there, then try to get back to it as quickly as you can. It's a good analogy, this. You're really cutting off your life's blood when you stray from the koan or the breath. Get back as quickly as you can. Don't waste any time. Treat it as an emergency. And as an emergency, stay calm. Just get back. We apply the same principle to koan work, of trying to make our awareness of the koan, our questioning of the koan, if possible, continuous, an unbroken stream. But should be pointed out, since we have been talking so much about breath practice in these last couple of days, that it must be that your awareness in breath practice is on the question, on your question, on mu, or who, or what, not directly on the breath. Though we're given the instruction in our tradition to breathe mu, or breathe who. But one has to be careful here not to get into a forced kind of breath as a way of sort of keeping the thoughts at bay, but to work with the natural breath, if we are keeping, uniting our work with, on the koan with the breath. But that's not the only way to work on a koan. It can be helpful at times, but it's also possible to completely question, independent of our breathing. We do that mostly when we're working or moving around. We might unite the question with our activity, our footsteps, or our movement of our hands and moving around in the kitchen, or with our sweeping, or whatever it is. But it's an interesting point that in Chinese Chan, they actually have a specific instruction not to unite the koan and the breath, because of this danger of then kind of being an agent that forces the breath, which is not very helpful. So it's not an absolute that you have to work with the breath or not work with the breath. It's something to be aware of, though, that you don't want to be pushing the breath out as you question mu. Because then there's a lot of agency, a lot of I in that. But then again, you don't want to be particularly bothered if you notice that you are doing that. Because then you're not questioning your koan. In koan practice, you really just turn everything over to the koan. You know that if you feel like your breath is kind of artificial or forced, if you just give yourself as fully as you can to the koan, that the breath will sort itself out at some point. It will just become more subtle and smooth and soft, because you get out of the way. And the fastest way to get out of the way is just to question your koan as sincerely as you can. One of the ways we get ourselves in knots, one of the ways we complicate the process, is by getting too focused on technique. We get to adjusting this and that and trying to get it all just right. And we lose sight of the spirit of the practice, which is just sincere involvement. It's a matter of heart, ultimately, not technique. So he's just set out here, first of these two terms, mindfulness, which is smirti. It's this continuous awareness of one's meditative object. And he turns to the other one, introspection, which is samprajanya. And this one, he says, introspection is quite a separate task from mindfulness. It serves rather like quality control in a factory. While mindfulness is attending to the meditative object, introspection is attending to the meditating mind, checking on how it's going. Am I still trying to control the breath? Am I chattering about the breath as I'm watching it? Am I falling asleep? Am I spaced out? Introspection also has the task of checking up now and again on the body. Check out the posture. The shoulders should be relaxed. Check that your face has not become tight, with the muscles around your eyes or jaws contracted. If you are accustomed to proper meditation, you may find you have a reliable posture and it doesn't need much introspection. In earlier phases of meditation, or if you're experimenting with different postures, attention to the body is more important. But the chief task of introspection is to monitor the mind, because the mind tends to change faster than the posture does. Note that introspection is not on call all the time. You don't need to have quality control checking every single item that comes off the assembly line, but you do want it poking in intermittently. In fact, it's going to be get in the way if it's on all the time. If the mind has become distracted, then it is the task of introspection to recognize this, and then you must apply your will to restore mindfulness. If you find you're going into a slump in the meditation, that vividness is gone and you're drifting off, then it's the task of introspection to note that and arouse the will to deal with it. Maybe you're just tired and it's time to end the meditation, go for a walk, or do something entirely different. Or maybe you need to pep it up a little bit and bring back the vividness. So this regulating process is associated with this introspective quality, rather than the mindfulness that we talked about earlier. But it should be pointed out that this is different from judging our practice. It's much more moment by moment than judging. Judging, we notice that we're sleepy, and then we add on top of that, I'm hopeless. This is pathetic. I'm sleepy again. Why do I always get sleepy? I've got such a dull mind. That's all the judging. But the introspection alone is just, oh, sleepiness, effort, put more effort in, wake up. So it's much cleaner. It's a little bit like what you do when you're riding a bike, where you're just always adjusting your weight on the bike to keep the bike upright, because bikes inherently tend to fall over. So when you start out, it can feel very awkward and quite shaky, and you're just too much one way or too much the other way. But once you've learned to ride, then there's all this adjustment going on, but it becomes almost second nature. All the little movements of the weight, pedaling and everything, to keep going forward and to keep upright. Introspection needs to be more frequent in the earlier phases of the practice, both towards the mind and the body. Eventually, you will learn to rest in a stable posture, and introspection will no longer be necessary for the body. Again, this relates to the bike riding. The adjustments we make to our body can become internalized to such a degree that we don't really have to consciously bring our awareness to them most of the time. Of course, there will be odd times when things shift, and then we'll notice suddenly that we're getting tense, or that we need to straighten up, or whatever it is. So at the beginning it's hard, but then this awareness becomes second nature. Think of that, something that Samuel Johnson said. I don't have my quote files with me here, but it's something like, what we wish to do with ease, we must first do with difficulty. As you progress, introspection is not needed so often, but it must become more educated and more acute. the types of problems to attend to become more subtle. If you do the practice with some continuity, there's a possibility of actually getting better at it. After several months, you may very well find that gross excitation is no longer much of a problem. Gross excitation or gross agitation occurs when mental distraction causes you to forget about your meditation object altogether. The breath is history, and you're now thinking about ice cream or pizza or where you need to go at 5 o'clock. When you get to a point in your meditation where gross excitation doesn't arise anymore, you may still experience subtle excitation. Subtle excitation is the background chatter that appears around the edges of your attention even as you are focused on the object. It may entail mental chit-chat or imagery. Introspection remains intermittent, but it has to be enhanced. In other words, it has to get more refined in picking up these more subtle subtle defilements. You may continue even further to a point at which both gross and subtle excitation are gone, and you can sustain mindfulness with finer and finer tuning. Think of the moments of awareness like a line of dominoes. The space between them gets narrower and narrower. When the space, which is the space between moments of mindfulness, is quite big, there is room for subtle excitation in between the mindfulness, so you have a sense of doing two things simultaneously. But as you start to close the distance between the dominoes, there's no space for other imagery. The line of dominoes becomes a seemingly smooth, seamless surface of mindfulness on your object. As you develop greater stability and the excitation decreases on both gross and subtle levels, then laxity is almost bound to arise. This feels like complacency. You are resting on the object, and the edge of awareness is gone. You may have some semblance of vividness, but it's not that great. You're slacking off. You need introspection to detect this, and the remedy is to give the meditation more intensity. And he goes on to say how difficult it is to talk about this stuff because it really is something you have to get in and experience for yourself. But it is something that will come up once you get more concentrated, that you can just kind of settle into the nice, smooth quality of the sitting and sometimes completely stop focusing on the breath or the koan. By the time you've moved through gross and subtle excitation, encountered both gross and subtle laxity, you're on easy street. From that point, you no longer need introspection. In fact, introspection then becomes a nuisance and detracts from meditation. It's not a line you cross, but a stage you move into gradually. There may be times, even relatively soon in your meditation, when you can honestly say, I don't need to do anything here. I don't need introspection. I can just go with the flow. To get to this point is when we can really trust doing nothing. This is when we start to move beyond regulation. Regulation implies someone doing the regulating and something being regulated. But one has to be careful. As always, when hearing these descriptions of the stages of the path, not to mistake where we're at. So we do need to be careful not to be premature about this and think, oh, I can just go with the flow, when in fact you're in a state of dullness. Then going with the flow will just sustain that dull state. He continues, note that introspection is auto-referential, a kind of inner monitoring. When introspection is no longer needed, because the problems for which it was designed are no longer present, at that point the reified sense of subject-object dichotomy begins to break down. You're left with just the experience, the event of mindfulness taking place with continuity and with vividness. It's from that space that you move right into the actual accomplishment of shamatha, true quiescence. That is an advanced state, but you will also almost certainly experience facsimiles of that state prior to achieving it. You get glimpses or brief tastes when you know for yourself that, for a while at least, there is no longer a sense of the meditator. The dichotomy between the meditator and meditative object is something that has to be constructed. It's not a given. Important to recognize this. This is something we create. This idea, it's an idea that there is a subject and an object. We put a lot of energy and effort into maintaining this division. Often where the thought of releasing this construct scares us. We construct it by conceptualizing it concretely, patting it into shape. That's the object. This is the subject. This is the meditation. And I'm doing well. Ah, yes, that's what we add to this whole subject-object thing. I'm doing well. Or, I'm not doing well. Think of as lines in the Affirming Faith in Mind. Abide not in duality, refrain from all pursuit of it. If there's a trace of right and wrong, true mind is lost, confused, distraught. And then a bit later on, both gain and loss and right and wrong, once and for all get rid of them. Get rid of them. Insofar as you release this ongoing commentary, you also begin to release the more quiet construct of I am meditating. And you release it simply by attending more closely and with tighter continuity, moving the dominoes closer together until there is no more space to also say, and oh yes, I'm meditating. It's all, we can free ourselves from this bind by just simply attending more and more closely to the breath or the koan. Until there's just no more room for that thought, I am doing this. There's no room for it. I just want to finish up, we haven't got much time left, by relating some of this stuff back to koan practice and how it differs in some respects. We've mentioned some of this already from breath practice. The main difference between koan practice and our breath practice is that in koan practice there's this element of questioning. In breath practice, we're honing our attention. We're developing stability, non-interference, vividness of mind. And when obstructions come up, we're using the power of our introspection to apply antidotes to whatever is coming up. And note here the parallel with what we're doing with our body. In our body, we balance tension and relaxation, to find poise. And in the breath practice, we work with counteracting too much agitation or restlessness. The word that Wallace uses is excitation. But then also counteracting too much laxity, dullness. So there's no questioning involved in all of this. It's a process of monitoring, but not questioning. With the koan work, we're not just keeping our mind on one thing, though that's very much a part of what we're doing, but we're also giving rise to a strong desire to find an answer, to see into the koan. And that's where the koan's power comes from. But always these things come with a shadow to them. There are pitfalls to this, because of the closeness of this wanting to find an answer to, you could say, that a near enemy of wanting to see into our true nature, to understand our koan, is grasping, craving. So we have to be vigilant about not falling into craving. You could say in the sense, in the fact that it works with desire, you could say that koan work is sort of tantric. It's taking an impure impulse and putting it to a pure end. So it has some dangers to it, but if harnessed correctly, this desire to awaken, to see into one's true nature, has great power. It marshals our energy. And this is very helpful for some people. Not for everyone. Koans are not for everyone. But for some of us, they can really galvanize the practice. Master Sheng Yen says about this, that this focusing the mind on the koan and also wanting to answer it force our self-centeredness into a corner. He says, by your persistent questioning, the self eventually has nowhere to go and vanishes. When the self vanishes, the answer you are looking for will manifest by itself, and you will come to know personally the state of liberation. By itself. We don't have to come up with the answer ourselves. We just have to get so caught up in the question that we forget ourselves. Then the koan opens. It's the moment of forgetting ourselves is when we move out of the regulating mode and beyond regulation, beyond subject and object. Well, our time is up. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.